The Gita verse that is part of our reading today is in chapter 18 of the Bhagavad Gita. There are only 18 chapters. It's right near the end. It's among the last three stanzas of the last chapter of the whole Gita. The Gita itself is a skinny little book, and Swami Kriyananda's commentary is a hefty book like this. So there's a whole lot of words before we get to where this last verse comes, and then there's about two more pages in the book. That's just the end of like 500 or 600 pages. So when Krishna says, "Hear my last word," it's the last word after a whole lot of other words. And all of those other words, when we start talking about the spiritual path, I was invited in to give a class on the Bhagavad Gita for our yoga teacher training course. And the Gita is a book, the Gita commentary is a book this big. I gave 52 classes on the Gita commentary at one point and decided that that was far too rushed, so I've started over. And I'm about on chapter 2 or 3 of the Gita, and I'm up to about 30 classes, so who knows how long this is going to take. I'm just going as long as I need to. So once again, when Krishna says, "This is my last word," so I have 3 hours with the yoga teacher trainees, and I'm a little free form in the way I do things. So it took us a while for me to say the word Gita, because I was doing lots of other things prior to that, and then the conversation went in lots of directions. But it was fascinating to me that pretty much every question that was asked, no matter how, where it came from, I was able to say it's in the book. Because the Gita, which has lasted for all these many, many centuries, since hundreds and hundreds of years ago when Krishna and Arjuna had this conversation, which became the book, it's because everything that we need to know about the spiritual path is in there. It deals with karma, reincarnation, death, rebirth, the nature of life, anger, desire, attachment, non-attachment, duty, right duty, wrong duty, intuition. I mean, just, it's a pretty long list. It's all in there. And once you go through all of this thinking, you finally get to this last verse. Hear my last word. Cling to me. Love me. Give me your heart. And what's being said there is not that Krishna is nullifying all that fabulous philosophy that came before. He's not going to turn against his own ideas. But he's telling you the difference between the means to the end and the actual experience that all of this is set for. See, we're caught in this weird, God knows why, and God does know why, but most of us don't know why, this strange human condition, which is just, I find it utterly bewildering. I've been here for a while, but still I find it utterly bewildering. I'm going to tell a completely unrelated joke. This woman, it's not a joke, this is a little Reader's Digest vignette. This woman was appointed to be the conductor of some major symphony orchestra, and perhaps she was the first woman to have that position, I'm not sure. So she's being interviewed by the journalists, and they say, "You know, how does it feel to be a woman conductor of this great orchestra?" She said, "Well, as for being the conductor," she said, "I'm just thrilled to have this opportunity. As for being a woman, well, I've been one for a long time." So, coming back, we've been in this human condition for a very long time. I, at least, still find it quite bewildering. What I find so bewildering is the confusion between aspiration and our ability to accomplish it. The confusion between how simple it seems to do the right thing and then how challenging it so often is to find the energy, to find the will, to find the faith, the commitment, the diligence, the perseverance, all these big words, you know, to really do what Krishna asks us to do. And the other half of our reading today is this statement from the Bible that the law was given by Moses, but grace and love came through Jesus Christ, which, you know, it's a pretty understood in in the wrong way, it's a pretty strong hammer for the Christians against the Jews, you know, that Moses was good, but not so very good. It really took Jesus to really finally make it work. And the human being loves that. The human being loves to have a reason to be better than somebody else and loves to support his way of doing it by saying that your way is not so good. As Sri Yukteswar said, people like to make themselves tall by cutting off the heads of others. The American Indian, this is another unrelated joke. Apparently, American Indians, Native Americans, commented when they heard about daylight savings time. They said, when you cut a foot off the top of the blanket and sew it to the bottom of the blanket, it doesn't make the blanket bigger. So by trying to make other people small, it does not really make us bigger. It just makes us feel bigger because we've smashed them down a little bit. So this particular verse from the Bible is not really very popular among the adherents of the Old Testament because it pretty much knocks Moses right off the stand. But what is really being described is so subtle that most Western scripture can't even touch it, because we have to have the understanding that comes from the Gita that this return, this constant sort of revelation brought by great masters, the dissipation of the power of that by human interpretation, followed by the return of the avatar to lift the teaching up to where it needs to be for that particular cycle of time, for the next yuga that's coming, whatever it might be. And that this is just an endless cycle, as all the masters say. The masters don't disagree, it's just their disciples who do. I remember I was talking to an Episcopal priest, and I was asking him a certain question about, he was a friend of mine in a Kriyabon. And I was asking him a certain question, meaning that he's on this path and he still served as a priest. I was asking him a certain question about the Christian, what was in the New Testament. I didn't quite understand something. And he gave me an explanation which did not match Master's teaching. So we had a further discussion in which he began to understand that, oh, but this was his explanation. I said, if Jesus said this, then why were they acting like this? He said, well, Jesus, the full revelation of Jesus' teachings did not really express itself for several hundred years, and only gradually, you know, did the theology come into focus. I just looked at him, and because we were both friends and also on this path, I said, so what you're saying is that Jesus didn't actually know what he meant. It took 300 years of scholars and theologians to really actually know what Jesus meant. This man had a master's in theology or a PhD in divinity from Yale Divinity School or something like that. He looked at me, he said, my life was easier before I met you. Yeah, I said, but it wasn't as much fun. No, he agreed. It wasn't as much fun. So, I mean, that's what we do. We just switch it all around and we don't understand. So the way Master described it is so much more interesting. Every avatar, every fully self-realized master who comes with a world-changing mission, they have a particular reason for incarnating. They're commissioned by the powers that be, whatever those powers are, by God himself, by the Himalayan masters, by those who run this planet, because the planet goes through all these different cycles, and souls come to incarnate on a planet because whatever's happening there is the karma that they particularly need. Yogananda was asked once, do we always reincarnate on the same planet? And he laughed and he said, oh no, there's many places to incarnate. We are by no means the only intelligent life in the universe. And all the planets are expressing different cultures and different realities, different stages in the yuga cycle. And when it's time for our soul to incarnate, we have the entire universe to choose from. From the astral world, the whole material world is accessible. So we go wherever it is that seems right for us to go because it's the right situation. And we go as disciples knowing that our master or some aspect of our master's life, some part of his work or some learning for us is going to happen. So the masters too come. So when Moses came, He came for the Jewish, what was called the Jewish people at that particular time. They had been enslaved and oppressed. It was time for them to become free. They needed this reality. Moses had his disciples among that group. So the avatar comes with the full revelation of infinity, but his message is defined and to an extent limited by the civilization to which he is called to teach and the karma of his disciples, what they need and what they can accept. So if he seems to disagree, it's not because he really disagrees. It's just that this is what was needed at this time to move these people on the planet, this planet, in this cycle forward. And as Master explains it, the Jewish people were coming out of slavery and they needed to know just how to live. It's very interesting in American history when the black people were freed after the Civil War, several very great souls and very saintly souls, George Washington Carver notable among them, came to teach that group of people sort of what to do next. And he was George Washington Carver was a scientist, but he was also a saint. And he taught them how to put their lives in order because they didn't know how. There was no cultural tradition except slavery at that point. So he helped invent what they were going to be. And so Moses, as an avatar, helped define it. And what was appropriate at that time was the rule of law. And this is not only progressive in spiritual history, this is also progressive for us as devotees. The first thing that happens is we're just living this life, just being knocked around by all our desires and all the circumstances, and we just don't know what to do. We need rules. And so you see people who get on a spiritual path where there are very clear rules. This is what we do on Monday. This is what we do on Tuesday. This is what we do at noon. This is what we do in the evening. These are the do's. These are the don'ts. And then the mind that is so wild can just begin to focus like this. I remember once I met a man who had been a drug addict, and now he was a Christian. And he really felt obligated to try to make me one according to his idea. And I couldn't accept it, but nor did I want to even touch his commitment to his teaching. Because I don't need these rigid rules and this excluding of everyone else. That's not my karmic position, but it was definitely his. And that's not to say the Jewish people, when Moses came, were not highly evolved. It was just the necessary. It was Kali Yuga descending. It was everything was going into form. Form needed to be set. But Jesus came, and he was still Kali Yuga descending, but they were beginning, it was the end of Kali Yuga. They were going to begin to come up the other side. Plus, many of those souls that were living in that particular tradition had gathered what they needed to gather from that kind of clear, precise discipline. And of course, it had become completely corrupted. The word Judaism doesn't really apply. It was corrupt priesthood, which exists everywhere. It was money and power and individuals using what they called religion to oppress people. And Jesus came, and there was already a powerful remnant in the Essene community of true mystical understanding that behaved entirely differently. Because you see, that's how we progress. First, we're lost, and we have no direction. Then we become afraid. And then we get clear guidelines. And then once we begin to discipline ourselves, we begin to experience. And that's the step that we move to next. Because it's not really that we do all these things externally. It's that by restraining from wrong behavior, we actually perceive this higher reality. And so Moses taught that God was the judge, essentially. Or at least that's how it evolved as they worked it out over time. Moses himself must have been filled with the love of God. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been an avatar. He must have been overflowing with joy and happiness and good cheer. Because that's what it is to be in tune with God. And without that power, how could he have attracted or influenced anyone? It's only time that makes him this avenging, you know, they spend 300 years learning what he really meant, and they decide that he meant it, that he was avenging, But he couldn't have been, because it's just not possible. Who would follow such a person? You go where you feel joy. That's what you do. So Jesus came to those who were ready. And he said, God is not this harsh judge like this corrupt priesthood is using over you. God is your Father. If you ask your Father for a loaf of bread, will he hand you a stone? Will he burn you in hell because you broke some tiny rule? And Jesus said the Sabbath was not made for man. I mean, man was not made for the Sabbath. But the Sabbath, which one does it go? I can't even remember. The rules were made to help you. The rule doesn't have an end in itself. It's only made to help you. And so Jesus said, go to the point where you're trying to go, which is love. Just be in that power of love. He couldn't quite bring them to the mother, because the mother was just too far from the law and the judge. But the father we could get to. Then Yogananda came and brought the mother. Just moved it one more step. But what Jesus brought was that attitude that God loves you. Awaken us to that. Not because the Jews didn't know it. The Jews must have known it, because otherwise Jesus wouldn't have been able to say it to them. They must have resonated with it. And it was also their mission. It's like the avatars come and they have a job. Yogananda came to awaken this country and this world into self-realization. If you look around, it's because people don't know it. And it's not because people are horrible and weak or anything like that. It's just now is the time. Now is the time for this message. And we, in our own selves, we have to always be balancing these realities. We have to balance the obvious necessity to know who we are, to know what we're supposed to do, and to have the will and discipline to do it. But the point of doing it is to free ourselves from distraction so we can have the experience that is intended. So after all the teaching about attachment, non-attachment, right action, wrong action, all Krishna says is, give me your heart. But in order to give God our hearts, we first have to have mastery over it. You see how it works? But the reason we want mastery over it is not to be able to suppress it, but to free it. To be able to direct it where it really belongs. You see, that's the confusion of this human condition. That somehow or another, we're always giving our hearts to that which is doomed to disappoint us. And don't misunderstand, loving one another, living together, caring for one another, serving for one another and the planet and the creatures and everything that's here, that's also giving our heart to God. If we give our heart to God through those experiences. So the masters are the kindest and the most loving of all, because they look everywhere, and everywhere they see the same divine. Swami Kriyananda once was approached by a man who was a visitor to our community. He'd only been there a few days. And with tears in his eyes, he said to Swamiji, he said, you don't even know me. He was talking to Swami personally, and he was also talking to the whole community, talking of the whole community. You don't even know me, he said, and yet I feel more love from you than I feel from my own family. And Swami's answer was so exquisite. He looked at him and he said, you're right. I don't know you. I don't know the details of your life and your history and all the things that your family knows about you. But when I look at you, I see the presence of God, whom I already love. And he said, that's the love I'm giving you. So when Krishna says to us, give me your heart, it means give me your heart in the silence of meditation. Give me your spirit when you offer your energy and life force up to the spiritual eye. But it also means give life your heart. As Swami says in his beautiful song, give life your heart, bless everything that's grown, fear not the loving, all this world's your own. make rich the soil, but once the seed is sown, you know, so whatever it is, seek freedom, don't linger. And the last line is, go on alone. But the point of all of it, all that we do, is what Krishna says at the end. You are ever dear to me. You are sweet to me. Come to me, and I will receive you. God bless you.
There lived a tender maid in a far off country. The strangeness of this world made her sigh. Her friends asked their fathers for money and clothes, but all she could ask was, solemn clouds gathered watching a rainbow, the bright rays of their joys filled the sky. Her teachers explained it all wisely away, but still her heart wondered. Silent stars thrill the night with their gladness. They seemed some wondrous truth to imply. Her elders all slept, but the magic of light awoke her to ponder. Smile as she tended her baby, a widow weep that love had to die. The joy of new friends and the sadness of parting, all these made her ask God, secret of oneness, the bond not even time can untie. For love then possessed her and made her his own. In love she at last learned. My help.
And even